Good evening, everyone. My name is John, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hey. Hello, John.
Hello. So, for the grace of God, this wonderful fellowship, good sponsorship, and home group, and people like you, it hadn't been necessary for me to take a drink since the 10th of April, 1995. And for that, I'm truly grateful.
Awesome.
But I say that, and then I have to say, so what? You know, because I'm reminded of what it says on page 85. You know, what we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Let me back up. It says, what it really says is, we are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And I'm working on that maintenance every single day because I don't want to go back to where I came from. Not a lovely place. Not a lovely place. All right. So, I had to make some notes to keep myself straight. And as I mentioned, I have a home group. I have a sponsor. And I sponsor folks. I actually have two home groups. One is Big Book Thumpers. So I'm going to be referring to this big book a lot because I am self-proclaimed and not embarrassed to say that I'm a big book thumper because what's in these pages has kept me alive today. My other home group is called Suffered Enough, and that is probably one of the largest groups in Richmond. They meet actually twice daily online, and if you're interested in online meetings, let me know. They meet at 7:30 a.m. every day and at 5 p.m. every day for an open topic. And then in the morning meetings, they rotate every day. They do Monday as Bill Season, Tuesday Daily Reflections, Wednesday's an open topic. Thursday's a big book study, which I'm currently chairing that meeting every Thursday online, the big book study. Friday is a tradition or a step meeting. And then Saturday, again, is an open topic, except for the fourth Saturday, where they have a speaker meeting on the fourth Saturday of every month. And then on Sundays, probably my favorite meeting. They actually meet at 9:30 a.m., both in person and online. We used to meet at this beautiful facility called St. Francis Hospital right off of 288 in Richmond there. We just started that meeting well into when the group was already established, but it was just a beautiful facility, and it was just so peaceful. And we alternate between the literature Came to Believe and Living Soul Sober every week, so we pick a story. And I'll get to that in a minute, but yeah, it's just a wonderful meeting, again, online and in person at 9:30, and these days, post-COVID, they meet at the Disabled American Veterans right off of 288. All right, so to help me settle my nerves, why I'm nervous, I don't know. I guess it's a whole public speaking thing, right? But just to settle my nerves, I'd like to start off with a prayer. And you know, the Sunday morning meeting, as I mentioned, it started at the St. Francis Hospital. So while we were forming this meeting, I had made a suggestion. Well, you know, one of our readings, one of our prayers, why don't we open up with the Peace Prayer of St. Francis, which is found on page 99 of the 12 and 12. So it's easy to find. In fact, in the 12 and 12, it suggests that you read it and then read it again a little bit slowly, and kind of digest every single word in there. It's a beautiful prayer that I'd like to start off with. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there is hatred, I may bring love, that where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness, that where there is discord, I may bring harmony, that where there is error, I may bring truth, that where there is doubt, I may bring faith, that where there is despair, I may bring hope, that where there are shadows, I may bring light, that where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds, it is by forgiving that one is forgiven, it is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. Amen. What a beautiful prayer. It's a long one. I've been saying that I'm going to try and commit that one to memory. And that's a tough one. So I started out with prayer. I'm off to a good start. They say there's two things I've learned in here. There's two things that everyone should know about prayer, and that's to start and don't stop. I think that's some pretty sage advice. You know, the Bible mentions, the Apostle Paul mentions several times, pray without ceasing. It's a lovely reminder right there. Okay, here we go. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Where, when, what, and why?
Where, when, what, why, and who?
How come you guys have so many questions? There's my where and when, and there's my joke out of that way. Oh, Lord. Who invited this guy? All right. Well, thank you for inviting me. And, you know, I'm reminded of the drive. I'm reminded of the drive up here. You know, 75 miles. I would do it again tomorrow, really. I'm reminded of the responsibility statement, right? I am responsible. When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to always be there. For that, I am responsible. So not only am I responsible, I'm truly grateful that you guys asked me to come up here. It's an honor because it made me really reflect just over the past couple of 3 days, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, you know, or as we say, my experience, strength, and hope. And hopefully I'll be able to pass some of that on to you. Any length, that we'd go to any length to get it, right? I'd go to any length to get a drink, that's darn sure, you know? So, here we go. I was born in Brooklyn, New York.
Brooklyn!
Into a very large Roman Catholic Irish family. Lots of cousins, lots of cousins. Lots of occasions to party, you know? My dad, he was born on March 14th, which if you track holidays, that's 3 days before St. Patrick's Day, right? And he was the only boy. He had three older sisters, and he was spoiled rotten, you know? But there was such a close-knit bunch of four. He lost his dad when he was like 5 years old, you know? So the family was, like I said, a lot of cousins, you know, my aunts, my uncles, we'd all get together for baptisms, communions, weddings, St. Patrick's Day, my father's birthday, you know, we'd have big parties, corned beef, cabbage on the stovetop and Irish music blaring, you know, you're always welcome at our house. That was the theme, you know, and of course, the Irish whiskey, the Irish coffee, and the beer was always flowing. And I liked beer. So I have one older brother. I have two younger sisters, and we are very, very close. Let's see. I was a very mischievous child. Trouble seemed to follow me. You know, I mean, we, you know, in Jersey, where I grew up, born in Brooklyn, Mike, you know, we moved over the George Washington Bridge to New Jersey. And this is an interesting fact. New Jersey lowered their drinking age from 21 to 18 in 1973, okay? I was born in 62, so I was 11 years old. That didn't impact me. But it raised it to 19 in 1980. And that was the year that I graduated high school. So 18, 19, you know, you're kind of close, you know. I would tend to hang out with older folks. So, I mean, I started drinking when I was 13 years old. So the drinking age really wasn't a factor, you know. But bar hopping when I was at that age, you know, we'd go play video games, you know, and hang out at these bars and try and drink all the imports that they have. And lots of opportunities for trouble, big trouble. Like I said, trouble followed me. And it started out early on, you know, in Jersey, as I was saying, they would have cabbage night, the night before Halloween, mischief night, some people call it, you know. So we'd go around and, you know, toilet paper people's houses as well. We decided to throw eggs at this guy's house. Why? I don't know, you know. But that... Well, I got caught and I got brought down to the police station, and you know, I was probably 12 years old, 13 years old, and boy, oh boy, I embarrassed the living crap out of my parents, you know. They had to come down to the police station, pick the kid up, you know, and So my father was a very hardworking guy. He went into Brooklyn every day and worked in a meat market. So, you know, raising four kids cost a lot of money. And he decided to send us to Catholic school. Got thrown off the bus, you know, for throwing snowballs off the school bus on our way to Catholic school, you know, and all sorts of other antics. I got thrown out. So my parents had to come sit in the principal's office with me while they said why their son is getting sons. My fault, but sons are getting expelled from Catholic school. And then, you know, we wound up moving and going to the next town over to a public school. And boy, oh boy, that was like night and day from like a 20-minute lunch to an hour lunch, pick my own schedule. You know, I'd have shop, printing, home economics. Okay, I have to take math and English too. All right, you know, but I mean, it was a lot of time for messing around and fooling around. And lunchtime, we'd go out, get 8-packs, come back, and, you know, be all blurry-eyed during English class and our humanities, English, whatever. Not good, not good, not a good start. Then I also got, you know, mischievous, you know, town pool right down the block from our house. You know, we'd all go drinking. Hey, it's hot out this summer night, you know, hop over the fence, go swimming. Dozen of us, two guys get caught, me and this other dude. As soon as the police car pulled up in front of the police station, the other dude ran. Johnny Rogers is the only one that gets brought into the me and my father had to come pick me up. By this point, it was ready to send me off to, you know, military school, whatever, to try and straighten me out. So I never got a DUI. How that's possible, I'll never know. Went to a lot of concerts, you know, living right over the George Washington Bridge in New York City, you know, Madison Square Garden, Long Island, you know, where the New York Islanders played hockey, New Jersey, Meadowlands, all the clubs in New York. I'd go to a lot of concerts. And along with that was a lot of drinking, you know. But I never got caught. But I'm ashamed to admit this. I really am. But, you know, coming home from New York City, you could go over like the George Washington Bridge to get to Jersey, or you could drive through the Lincoln Tunnel to get home. And there were too many occasions where I don't remember when I woke up the next morning if I drove through the tunnel or drove over a bridge. And that's frightening, you know? It's really frightening. And thinking back on it, you know, I mean, me and my buddy down the block, I bought my very first car from this guy. He sold, he also sold one of my best friends a beautiful 67 GTO convertible, right? Mm-hmm. I got this beautifully restored 64 Dodge push button transmission, 2-door coupe that was just spray painted. All the bodywork was done. It was really nice. The very first weekend, I got that car. We're out drinking on our favorite spot on the golf course of all places. I regret that now. We're working at a golf course, you know, leaving all the bottles, leaving bottles and beer caps around and sitting on the greens and stuff, drinking. But after we got done drinking, we all jumped in the car. We got to the bottom of the block, and my friend turns around in his convertible and goes, "Don't you follow me that close anymore, right?" So I got a car full of guys. We go not even a mile further, and I'm talking to someone. He sees a buddy of his limping, so he pulls over to the side of the road, and I clip his quarter panel. I didn't have this car a week. I take my keys out. I go home. You know, I'm surprised my friend didn't beat the living crap out of me. It was much bigger than me. But he worked in a body shop, too, so he actually wound up fixing my car, which was kind of an enabler, I guess, at the time. But I go home, park the car. I go upstairs, and this is just really odd. I was drunk, you know. I put my keys to my first car, my dad's nightstand. I was like, "Dad, you need to go anywhere." You know, like he was in bed, you know. Next morning, he wakes up. He goes, "What happened to your car?" Oh, God. Oh, God. To this day, I feel the shame of the ridiculousness of that. Anyhow, so I'm a product of the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. And part of the 90s until I got sober. But, you know, I mean, I was in high school. I was not a jock. I was into punk rock, into disco, into rock and roll, as I shared country and western, lots of concerts, as I said, and lots of occasions to drink. So I earned my seat here. I really did. I was a blackout drinker. I was a blackout drinker that really wanted to learn how to control my drinking. And, you know, my Big Book Thumpers group, we used to have two meetings. We'd have a 7 o'clock meeting where we would, would last for 45 minutes at 7 o'clock, and then we'd have an 8 o'clock Big Book study, and the room would be full at both meetings until COVID. But we would read from chapter three, more about alcoholism, the first page to, you know, here are some of the methods we tried, you know, we'd read that. But, and I always wondered why we read that at our beginners meeting. And one of the old timers there reminded me of what it says here in the second paragraph. It says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery, right? Be honest, be honest. Being honest with ourselves, that's the principle of the first step, right? Being honest. Now about controlling my drinking, that's what I really thought I would gain by going to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, you know. The next paragraph goes on to say, we alcoholics are men and women, people, who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We're convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in a grip of progressive illness over any considerable period, get worse, never better. Control, that's what I wanted to do for so long, you know. I was a blackout drinker for a very long time. So, you know, after the accident and with my car, I really didn't know what the hell I wanted to do with, I really didn't know what the hell, heck I wanted to do with my life. But I knew that this drinking business was getting old, you know. I applied to, I finally decided, I had a friend of the family who was a pilot, and I finally decided, you know what, I think I'd really like to travel to outer space someday. And how do you do that? Well, you should become a pilot probably, and then you become an astronaut, right? So he suggested I check out this school in Daytona Beach, Florida, called Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. Well, I decided to go down there and explore it. So we did it during a spring break to Fort Lauderdale, you know. When I checked out the school, then went down to Fort Lauderdale. You could just imagine, you know, spring break, Fort Lauderdale. I had no business being there. But luckily, you know, I made it back alive, applied to the school, and amazingly got accepted. Because, like I said, you know, home economics, printing, home shop, and ceramics. My GPA, I didn't even know what a GPA was. Honest to God, when I graduated high school, I did not know what a GPA was. When I got to college, my roommate, if he didn't make a 90, if he didn't make 100 on a test, he was mad. I'm telling you, he was mad. You know, I'm like, dude, you passed. So my first report card came out and it was a 1.33 GPA, which is like a D minus, you know? And he's like, wow, you know? So you know, I had to retake all these classes, and I was on you know, a Pell Grant and student loans, and I mean, I was working, but that was a wake up call, and I buckled down and actually managed to graduate in like just over 4 years. I had to take a little bit more, you know. So while at Embry-Riddle, the world's finest aviation institution, I also enrolled in ROTC, and this really gave me a lot of discipline in my life. Really did, much needed discipline, I might add. And so after 4.5 years, I actually got a navigator slot to become a navigator. And then, you know, through the times changing, they needed more pilots. So I actually got an opportunity to go to flight school And I made it all the way up to my solo flight, and they said, "No, you got to find another career rider." So I wound up becoming a supply officer in the United States Air Force, and aim high. That's where my drinking really took off, because you know, even in college, you know, I waited 5 years between when I graduated until I went into college. I graduated in 80, didn't go to college till I was 85. I had to get a waiver for all my speeding violations. But when I got there, I was like 5 years older than most everyone there. And a lot of these kids there, their parents were paying their way. I was paying for my own. So a lot of kids never made it back to their second semester because they were just partying. I remember driving on Daytona Beach in my at this time I had a different car. And I remember driving on the convertible on the beach in Daytona with a stack of books like this, you know, and I was going to study on the beach. Yeah, right. I did a U-turn, went back to the library. It's one of the smartest decisions I ever made in my college. Also worked at the Ocean Deck, which is a bar on the beach, you know. And the damaging part of that was after every shift, the owner was really smart. He would give every employee 2 free drinks. Yeah, who's going to stop at 2 free drinks? Now, of course, you have nothing like paper and whatever. I don't know how I made it home from there. But anyway, graduated Embry-Riddle, go off and join the Air Force, and had a wonderful 20-year career in the Air Force. I got in a lot of trouble. I got stationed in Germany. And this is where things really turned south. You know, I was stationed there and living with a local national. And towards the end of my assignment there, I got in a whole lot of trouble. As it turns out, this relationship wasn't going nowhere. And just a few months beforehand, some gypsies broke into my apartment where we live. They stole some of my stuff and some of her stuff. And so I filed this claim with the government, you know, about all the stuff that was stolen. Some of it was hers. I just put that on the same claim. And when it was time for me to move out of this other apartment that we were living in together, it was just a really bad breakup. And she had this coat on, and I like approached her, and she wasn't going to give me this key, which represented around 1,500 Deutschmarks, about $1,000. She didn't want to give me the coat, the key. So I stuck my hand in the winter coat, and I just ripped it off, you know, off of her person. So I got in a lot of trouble. I got a letter of reprimand. I got an Article 15. And for an officer, this is really, really bad news, let me tell you. So I got this lovely letter. And in it, you know, when I tried to refute what happened, this two-star general tells me in writing, "Your excuses are a weak attempt to transfer the blame for your immature and dishonest behavior." That stung a lot. So I was in a lot of trouble for a really long time. Well, dust settled a little bit. I was fortunate to still stay in the Air Force, and they sent me off to this school that it was, you know, for future promotions there, right, in Alabama. I get a knock on the door, and there was the Office of Special Investigation that wanted to know, you know, about all this. And they brought me back to Germany, and I get to Germany, and it's like, after like a 12-hour flight, whatever, you know, 6-8-hour flight to go back to Germany, I get there to answer on these charges. And the night I got back to Germany, I went back to my old bar hangouts. You know, it was really easy to get around because the trains are on time and everything like that. I got so drunk the very first night I got back there. I had no recollection whatsoever of what happened. And I was concerned, did I go to this woman's apartment? Did I harm her? I had no idea. I woke up in a hospital, you know, and it was a really scary occasion. So for like 2 weeks, I didn't drink. And then I went out and tried to do some controlled drinking again. And I used to go to this place called the Schlockhaus in this area of town called the Sachsenhaus. And there was just like bar after bar after bar for like a square mile. It was just crazy. But on Sunday morning, they would have a live band, and by noon, people would be dancing on top of the band on tables to rock and roll music, you know? And I went in there, I said, okay, I'm going to control the beer. I'm going to have one beer. Now, mind you, this beer was that big, you know? I was successful, but when then we were walking around, me and a few friends, and by the end of the afternoon, you know, there we are playing Deutschmarks, playing drinking wine games, like quarters with Deutschmarks, and we get back to the hotel, and my phone rings. And it was this guy known as Rhein-Main-Bill. That was the air station out there, Rhein-Main Air Base. And this guy known as Rhein-Main-Bill calls me up. He goes, hey, John, heard you're in town. I was like, yeah, maybe I'll see you tomorrow. You know, this guy was just a civilian. He'd come pick up his mail. And every time I saw him, I'd say, hey, how you doing, Bill? I knew he was in the program because he helped my friend who had a drinking problem get sober, right? So that's how I knew him. And then the very next day, I see him at the officers club at lunch, and I sat down and I'm like, you know, 2 weeks ago I got back in town and woke up in a hospital. I'm like, you think I'm an alcoholic? He goes, I can't tell you that, John. He goes, but if you want, I'll pick you up on Wednesday night and I'll take you to a meeting. Now I'm going to back up a little bit and reflect on growing up and in Jersey. And we go over to visit my nanny, my dad's mom, in Brooklyn. And sometimes we'd cut through the city. A lot less traffic back in those days. And sometimes we'd find ourselves on the Bowery, you know? And in the Bowery, in New York City, in July and August, the hottest days of the year, you would have seen, and probably still today, I don't know, I'll go by that. People in warm raincoats, you know, paper bottles, drinking out of paper bottles, you know. Mom, what's that? That's an alcoholic, you know. So in my mind, that's an alcoholic, you know. I did have a friend that I went to a couple of meetings with, but, you know, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm a blackout, immature, dishonest, drunk. But don't call me an alcoholic, you know. So in fact, that's the reason why when I introduce myself at meetings, I like to qualify myself as a grateful, recovering alcoholic. I think there's a big difference right there. So Bill takes me to my first meeting, and like I said, I've been there with my couple friends, and you know, next to nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, next to nothing. Go to my first meeting, and they're going around the table and introducing themselves. And I'm like, you know, this much I knew from movies and TV. When it gets to me, I got to say, my name is John. I'm an alcoholic. I could have passed, I guess, you know, but what was I there for? You know, what was I there for? A cross-section of people, men, women, you know, black, white, a lot of Germans. When it got to me, I don't know why, probably the realization just hit me. I said, my name's John, and I'm an alcoholic, you know. People gave me their phone numbers. I was in the Air Force at the time, as I said, and the first sergeant who I had never met up to this point, because we were downsizing the base in Rhein-Main, the first sergeant who I had never met before, he was an alcoholic. His father-in-law was an alcoholic with almost 30 years. He gave me the keys to his car. He goes, I heard you go into meetings and you might need some transportation, you know? Hands me the keys to the family car so I could go to meetings. Never met the guy before now. The chaplain at the installation, he was an alcoholic. So within a month or so, he had to go on a temporary duty, and he had a dog. He said, here's the keys to my apartment. Can you watch my dog? You gonna trust me? Who's got this article with me hanging over his head, you know? Who's a drunk? You gonna trust me with your house and your dog? Wow. I mean, these are the types of people I met right early on in recovery. And show me the way. You know, Howard was the first sergeant. That was his name, Howard. I go to his house, and they had such a routine. They, you know, we'd go to church actually every Sunday morning together as a family. You know, him and his wife and his two daughters, and then we'd go to his house, have some lunch, and they would proceed to clean their government housing. You know, and on his armchair, he would have the 24-hour-a-day book and the daily reflections. And that got me into a really wonderful habit of picking these things up and getting into prayer and meditation on a daily basis. And for that, I'm truly grateful. So, plenty enough about my experience, my drunk log, if you will. I'd like to move on to my experience with the steps. You know, the first steps, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. It was pointed out to me just this past Monday that, in you know, how it works there, a lot of groups will read, you know, how it works, the 12 steps and then the ABCs. 27 times we is mentioned in that first reading. I never thought about that, you know, 27 times the word we. You know how many times I is mentioned in there? Once. I can't go through with it, right? I can't go through with it. Step two, came to believe, right, and a beautiful principle behind the first step, honesty. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I don't know about you, but waking up and not remembering if you drove over the George Washington Bridge on the upper or lower deck or through the Lincoln Tunnel, that is insane. You know, I just hope, and I really hope and pray that I never caused any accidents or anything like that. It's just a real eye opener. Three, the third step prayer. That's a long one. That's a long one too. And I really don't have a good memory. As you see, I have all my notes. Like, you know, and I also shared that I went to a lot of concerts, very into music. I have a very short memory. I have a hard time remembering things like prayers, you know, the Peace Prayer of St. Francis. But the third step prayer, I was really committed to doing that because my other home group, the Suffered Enough home group, had a group conscience once. And some of the members said, you know, maybe we shouldn't say the Lord's Prayer because it might be offensive. So someone suggested that we close with the third step prayer. And, you know, ever since then, I not only learn it, but I say that prayer at least once a day, you know. In fact, my routine is when I get into my vehicle, I start the car and I sit there and I let the engine warm up, let the oil go through those cylinders and everything. And I say that third step prayer every single day. And I try and say with meaning, you know, not rote. Beautiful prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Amen. And when I go to my online meetings, which I pretty much do it every day, you know, if there's anything that good that came out of COVID, and there's one that I could think of, only one, is the online meetings, and we close the meeting every day with the third step prayer. So I'll say it then, and then again when I hit my car, and then probably throughout the day, because I pray and meditate a lot. We were reborn, yeah. Four, you know what? I hopped right on the struggle bus with step four. I did not want to do this, you know? I did not want to do this. It was tough because, first of all, I'm not a list maker to begin with, you know? And then to look at my defects of character, I can look at you or someone else down the street, you know, and point them out. And the funny thing about that is it's usually like a mirror. Because when somebody does something to piss me off, excuse me, upset me, I really need to look at myself and do a step 10 right then and right there and say, uh-huh. Because as they say, if you spot it, you got it, right? Yeah, it was tough. It was tough, but I did it. And after I got released from my sentence in Germany in 1995, it really wasn't a sentence. I mean, all things considered, I got off lightly. I was supposed to go from Germany to Korea. And I had just purchased this brand new Harley Davidson motorcycle. And I remember this guy saying, oh, you're going to have so much fun, a single guy over in Korea, you know, they drink so much. It's like a fraternity house. And I'm like, oh my God, you know. Well, because of the circumstances, that tour got canceled. And I said, you know what? I kind of just want to go to the middle of nowhere and start learning about this internet thing, you know, that was coming about in 1995. Because I was taking college classes while I was still in Germany. And I remember this professor one day from Embry-Riddle as I was getting my master's degree. He brought into the classroom his computer. He plugged something into the side of it, and he brought up AOL. And he was talking about this crash, airplane crash that happened just the night before. And he did all this through his computer. It was like magic. I mean, in 1995, this was magic. Okay, here we are. I'm like, I gotta learn how to do that. You know, so I volunteered to go to Altus, Oklahoma. So I had to go pick up my motorcycle, which I left in Alabama at my cousin's house in South Carolina. And I pick it up at the Harley dealer. They were kind enough to keep it there for free for me and store it until I was, you know, let out. And I hit station in Oklahoma. Now, this is right after Timothy McVeigh did that horrific bombing in Oklahoma City. And that was about 60 days after I got sober. So I jump on my motorcycle and I go to bike week down in Daytona. And actually, that was okay. You know, I had just enough sobriety to get through that. And then I started driving my motorcycle out to Oklahoma. And I ride my motorcycle into this one-lane road into a two-horse town. And I met this guy there. When I left Germany, they had a directory at the time. You don't know where now. They had this directory, and they told me. I got a guy's name, you know, in there. So I called this guy up at the diner, and he came and met me. He picked me up, and he drove me around. There were two meetings in town. One where they allowed smoking. This guy was about 80 years old and didn't smoke. He says, I don't go there because they smoke and it's bad for my lungs. He took me to this other church where they also met, and I would go there. And he was sponsoring this World War II prisoner of war veteran, Andy. So Ro and Andy really got me going. I mean, they gave me a place, you know. He had an apartment above his 2-car garage that he allowed me to rent, you know, and we'd go to meetings all the time. And this guy got locked up so many times in his town jail. It was just a trip, you know. He'd been sober like 40 years, you know, and he would tell his story about there'd be a piano and over in the corner of the church room, and he says, you know, if I tried to move that by myself, I might could, but. But together, if I got a few people, we could do it, you know. And then that was kind of his message, you know. And I was struggling, like I said, with the fourth and the fifth step. And he finally, you know, he kept on egging me on. And I finally sat down with Andy, a World War II POW, and did my fifth step. And man, what an experience. I had a lot off my chest. And he was a good listener. And it was good to get rid of that garbage. I'm going to back up to... So after I picked up my motorcycle in South Carolina, my cousin's house, I was really excited to be back in America. And I said, you know what? I want to go to my first meeting in America, you know? So I go to Aiken, South Carolina, okay? And I pull up on my Harley. And in this meeting, my first AA meeting in America, I it wasn't a milestone or anything, but I wanted to pick up a chip. I went in there with the notion that I'd like to get a chip at this meeting, you know? So how am I going to do this, you know? And there was this really pretty woman chair and then giving out the chips. And I was like, ah, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to just go up and get a hug and a chip from this woman because I don't have a reason to. So I walked out and then I was like, all right, I really wish I got a chip. So I'm standing at the window. This guy comes up to me and goes, is that your motorcycle out there? And I go, yeah. He goes, let me give you some. He gives me this master link from his motorcycle. He goes, this is like a chip. This guy lies serenity. You just can't make this stuff up, right? You just can't make this stuff up. And then driving down. So after I left there, like I said, I went to bike week and backing up a little bit. Going down to bike week, and I had a friend who was a sheriff down there. He used to take me to school in the squad car. It was really funny. So I was hanging out with them, and I'm driving down the road towards his place. And all of a sudden, there's a cop pulling me over. I'm like, what in the hell? Cop goes, broad daylight, one of your headlights is out. I'm like, really? Come on. You know, I'm sober, you know, still ego was swollen. You know, really? You pull me over for a headlight? It's broad daylight. Get back on the bike. 2 miles down the road, there's a tractor trailer across the road. There was an accident. I'm like, it still sends chills down my spine. I think about that, you know. Nothing, absolutely nothing happened to God's will. That's taken from Dr. Alcoholic Addict, or acceptance was the answer. Oh, shucks. Yeah, Roe and Andy, they helped me out a lot in Oklahoma before I ever, when I got back from Germany. Step 6 and 7, I'll just say drop the rock, you know? I don't know if y'all, it's non-approved AA literature, you know, and I used to... But let me tell you, it's a good book, really good book. There was a group of us, 12 dudes, who liked to golf, liked to get together, fellowship, and we kind of had a book group. And we read the book and talked about it and shared around a campfire and played golf. And after that golf outing, it was funny. 12 of us, we're returning our carts, and I said, come on, let's gather around, let's get a picture of this, you know? So I said, excuse me, ma'am. She was running the beverage car. I said, would you mind getting a picture of the 12 of us? She goes, sure, only if you'll let me buy you all a drink, right? I'm like, well, it's probably, I don't know, over a couple hundred years of sobriety right here. She goes, I'm sober too. What are the odds, you know? It's like that story in Came to Believe, mathematical coincidence, yeah. Right? If you've read that story, it's really one of my favorites in that book. Drop the Rock. Can't recommend that book enough. Really, really good. Again, I mentioned never a list maker myself on step 8 and step 9. Ready, willing, and able. 10. Love this steps. Love this step. Step 10, you know? It really keeps me straight on a daily basis, you know. One of the most beautiful blessings of the program is, I've been married about 26 years and sober just about 27, 28 years. So I got married early on in sobriety. And my wife's never seen me take a drink, but she has seen me emotionally intoxicated on too many occasions, if I'm really honest with you, you know? But thank God for that 10th step, you know? We share this a lot in my home group, suffering enough that the hardest place to work this program is in your home, you know? But life is good. Life is good. Happily married. I like her. I love her. In fact, she was going to come on up here with me, but... She's never heard my story. Maybe that's all right. She's lived it for 28 years. God bless her. Say some prayers for her and me, please. step 11 prayer meditation, prayer. I said it earlier, you know, pray without ceasing. And I prayed a lot, a real lot. Past couple of years, I've been studying the Bible. And this guy I studied with, he made a suggestion to me that, you know, if you spend 15 minutes a day, you could make it through. You could read the entire Bible in a year. So years ago, I was at this national prayer breakfast, and this chaplain gave such a wonderful sermon. It was just a miraculous story that he told. And afterwards, tears of joy were just streaming down my face after he had spoken about this miracle that occurred to his daughter. And afterwards, he gave us, handed out Bibles, the one-year Bible, it's called, you know? And it gives you a little bit of the Old Testament, a little bit of the New Testament, a psalm, and a proverb. And 15 minutes every day, I've read through the Bible now once, and I do it every day. You know, I read and pray and meditate on that. And I also got some other non-AA related books that I do. And as I said, I've been to more AA. Well, I didn't say this, but I've been to more AA meetings in the past 2 years due to COVID than I have in my 28 years. Right, I haven't gone the opportunity to attend the meeting every single day, right from my kitchen. You know, drinking my coffee in my room. It's a beautiful thing. So if you haven't tried it online, I highly recommend it. All righty. So I finished my 20-year career in the Air Force. It was time for me to retire. Well, I didn't want to, but they told me it was time to retire after 20 years. My mom had passed away. I chose my retirement date, which would be on the 1 year anniversary of when my mom passed away. And so my brother was there, my two sisters, all my nephews, my nieces, my wife, my stepson, his wife, our two grandkids were there. And it was a beautiful occasion, you know, 1 year to the day after my mom died. I never thought my mom wouldn't make it till I retired, you know, but she had a stroke and she was gone within a couple of weeks. So I retire and now what, right? So within 2 months after my retirement date, my father got diagnosed with a brain tumor. And, you know, my brother, my sister-in-law has MS, and my brother's caretaker. My sister has this really rare form of skin cancer, and they all work, but I wasn't working. So, you know, when I look back on it, I didn't want to retire, but I retire. My father has this brain tumor requiring surgery, and then, and that was in January, and by May, he was dead, you know. So I got to spend and be my father's caretaker for, right up until Memorial Day. It was just such a blessing, you know, that if I was drinking, I couldn't have handled it, you know, because it was tough. It was tough. It was tough on him, but and he had so many damn medicines, you know. It's like if I wasn't sober, I wouldn't have been able to manage that. You know, mentally and all the challenges that it brought along with it. So I'm truly grateful for that. Well, right after that Christmas, my mom, you know, I'd speak to my mom all the time, and she would always send cards, send gifts, birthdays, and all that jazz, you know. So I remember it was Christmas time, and I went outside to do something, and I look on the step, and I'm like, huh. And I thought, you know, my mom would always send a package for Christmas, you know, but she's gone. There'll be no more packages, you know? And I was kind of bummed out. I go inside, I get a phone call from my sister. She goes, did you get my package yet? I went, no. And she goes, it says it's delivered. Go look. So I go out the front porch, and and here's this package. I open it up. My sister was in the jewelry business, and she had this cross made, and there's a ring around the cross. The cross is made from my father's wedding band, and the silver ring around the cross is from my mom's wedding band. You know, so there was the gift from my mother, sent by my sister. You know, it's just like all these blessings. They just keep coming about. And in fact, I'm kind of getting short on time, and I'll conclude with this. So yesterday, a long while ago, I have this mailbox that I share with my two neighbors. So it's one of these mailboxes where there's three mailboxes on it, right? Well, one day I go out to put up the little flag to tell the postman that there's a letter to please pick up. And so I go to put the flag up, and the whole freaking thing goes. It was a cold, really chilly, rainy day. So I get my wife out there, we get some cinder blocks, and we put this whole thing into these cinder blocks, and it was like that for too long. So finally, you know, Labor Day, I get some time to, you know, where the postman's not gonna be here for 2 days. So last night I was gonna go out there in the cover of dark and surprise my neighbors and start digging this hole, put the post in. Well, there's a hornet's nest there, right? So I put some sand in it, but they're all around. So I get some hornet spray and I spray. So I got out this morning, right? As the sun's coming up, I want to get out there early. You know, I don't want to do this on a Sunday labor. You know, I'm out there, I'm digging. I dig a 3-foot hole. My whole arm is down in there. I put the post in, put the cement in, cover it up, and go back in the house, right? And while I'm digging that hole, I'm reminded of what this gal from my home group, who I, you know, pray for Karen, because I hadn't seen her in a real long time. She would say, you know, if you want to find your bottom, stop digging. So I was thinking about that as I was digging this hole. Then I go inside, and at my 9:30 meeting, from we alternate between Came to Believe and Living Sober, as I mentioned. Well, this morning was from Living Sober, and the chairperson this month chose this reading. God was the postman. And while I was doing it, I was listening to this. I listened to this radio station stream at Boston, Massachusetts. They put up wonderful music. But on Sunday mornings, they have this Right Mind Media, an award-winning media group dedicated to broadening addiction and mental health awareness. So there was this podcast, and this gal was sharing her experience, strength, and hope. So I'm digging this hole, listening to that. It was just so damn cool. But the postman, you know, God was the postman, right? And I shared on this meeting what the motto of the postal worker creed: neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. Just like God, right? He's always there. He's everywhere. Our higher power is everywhere. I'm going to conclude right now with this. Experience, strength, and hope. Here goes your hopes, peeps. All right, so a friend of mine shared this. It goes about addiction. I wouldn't recommend addiction to anyone, but the process of recovery has things in it that are valuable for all of us. It breaks you down and builds you back up stronger. In fact, addiction is the only disease that can make you into an improved version of yourself once you treat it. With any other disease, you can only hope to get back to as good as you already were before. By this measure, I consider addicts and alcoholics in recovery to be the luckiest people in the world. There goes your hope. And that is a quote from a book by Stevie O. The title of it is A Hard Kick in the Nuts. Sorry. I love you all. Nothing you can do about it. Thanks for having me.